This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Lee Treeland. What does it take to create a sustainable ecosystem that allows social enterprises to flourish? Cal Joff from Tandemic is back for his monthly show on social innovation, and he is joined today by Malaysian social entrepreneur Grace Tsai, who founded The Hub Singapore and is an advisor for social entrepreneurship for Magic. I'm pleased to have both of them in the studio with me to take a look at successful examples in other countries and discuss what can be implemented here in Malaysia. Welcome to the show. Firstly, what are the prerequisite ingredients necessary for social enterprises to thrive? Let's start with a big question.
Sure, I'll go first. Hi, everyone. It's great to be back in Malaysia and especially helping Magic with its social entrepreneur strategy. So a very good question. Social enterprises basically exist when the government or the private sector have neglected some issues or problems that, you know, and they need some entrepreneurial and innovative solutions to solve, right? So if social enterprises can come with a better, faster, cheaper, or more accessible solution and innovation, that's where it's a really critical piece of the economy and of societal's fabric. So first of all, you will need social and environmental problems for that would excite social entrepreneurs, right? And normally they are neglected and important, and they would have negative spillovers if not solved. So that would be the first thing. The second thing, of course, you need a very enabling infrastructure, both from the government, the private sector, banks, financial services, professional services, and most importantly, you will need the hunger and the drive of individuals, right? Malaysians and Malaysia-based entrepreneurs who want to take on some of these big, giant, hairy problems to solve. So is that drive really from individual entrepreneurs that would make or break an ecosystem?
Looking at the nitty-gritty of it, though, I mean, the word neglected, it kind of sparked the thought. I mean, when something's neglected, by and large, it's also ignored financially, right? And so when somebody decides to tackle this problem, how then do you secure funding and, you know, secure sustainable funding and ensure that people get interested enough in this traditionally neglected issue?
Well, I think it really depends on your business model as a social entrepreneur. So in some cases, you don't really need outside funding to address a social issue. So if you're selling a product to a market that's willing to pay for it and that's able to pay for it, then your social enterprise is self-sustaining. And that's kind of the ideal for a social enterprise. But in many cases, you need external funding to start up or even to sustain what you're doing as a social entrepreneur. And in those cases, you really need to have some forward-looking funders to do that. So, you know, organizations like Magic and others that are and CSR even that are investing in social enterprise. But I'd say that the really big challenge from my perspective anyway, the really big challenge that we're facing is not enough social entrepreneurs. So we really need people to step up and say, hey, I want to build an enterprise around solving this social issue.
Why do you think there's that lack in the first place? Why are so few people deciding, okay, you know, this is something that I want to step up to the plate to accomplish?
Well, to be honest, the biggest barrier of my 7 years being in this sector globally is your immediate ecosystem. So these are your parents, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your childhood friend, and they are the first ones who will say, no, don't be a social entrepreneur. That's crazy. Go and get a safe-paying job.
Go work in a bank.
Yeah, go work in a bank. Go be a lawyer. Mm-hmm. I got that when I first started when I was 24, and my dad, who's probably listening in right now, do not call in. He and I did not agree that it was the right path for me, and we didn't talk for 6 months as a result of that, right? So the, you know, as intermediaries like ourselves here, that's really an issue that we need to address and kind of redefine what success is on an individual level, also on a national level. That is really, really cool to be a social entrepreneur, and you can make money and meaning at the same time. It's not a trade-off.
Many countries try to encourage social enterprises by recreating an ecosystem that's worked elsewhere. Is this the best way to cultivate a social enterprise landscape?
So one of the things that when I started working on this kind of building of the social enterprise ecosystem in 2009, that was kind of one of the mistakes I feel that we made. So there was a band of us, and basically we tried a number of things, ranging from starting a social venture fund to invest in social enterprises, to all the way to creating a kind of an association for social enterprises and sort of workshops. And these were all things that were replicated sort of from the startup ecosystem. But for a very long time, it kind of felt that while we were getting increased interest in the space, we weren't getting the traction that we wanted to see in terms of people actually starting social enterprises. And so the big learning for me, or the takeaway from that, was that we shouldn't copy directly the things that people are doing in the startup space. We need to look at what is the situation in the social enterprise space. And the difference between the two, what it comes down to is that while in the startup space, there's a steady flow of people who are starting up companies almost wherever you go, in the social enterprise space, we need to generate that flow in the first place. We need to generate that flow of social entrepreneurs. So today, Malaysia probably produces less than 10 social entrepreneurs a year. And we need to get that number up in order to be ready to have accelerators and social venture funds and other, and certain other programs that would help.
So looking at our neighbors, how did Singapore develop its ecosystem for social enterprises?
So in 2009, right after the Asian financial crisis, the Economic Development Board and other ministries got together and did an economic review. And it was then that they concurred and agreed that entrepreneurship, homegrown ventures, are very important for the sustainability and future of Singapore. And since then, the president of the country, the prime minister, and all these ministries are investing in growing these homegrown startups and social enterprises. So it started with that signal. But having said that, there was already a lot of emergence bottom up. So these are, you know, very proactive Singaporeans or Singapore-based people who you know, are not waiting for the government or the private sector to solve some of the problems that are bugging them. So they already have started these things, right? So when the hub started in 2012, about 2.5 years ago, the whole ecosystem was a little bit fragmented. People were doing similar things. They were not talking to each other. And most of all, they were not cooperating and handing off things where it matters. And therefore, you don't get a maximum impact of effort. So ever since we started, our community now is at 500 people. Now there is a louder voice for the ecosystem and for social entrepreneurship in general. So there are many pieces that need to come together, right? Top down, bottom up, intermediaries. All these things must come together.
Yep. And at the beginning of that, you know, as you mentioned, the ministries got involved and so on. And I think that makes a lot of sense, right? Needing the support of government to a certain extent. But earlier you were talking about, you know, the importance of your immediate ecosystem as well. And have you seen a change of mindset with that in Singapore? Because I think they are at least as driven, if not more, more driven by finances and the importance of, I suppose, social status.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one reason, you know, Cal and I were talking just now of you know, me being very excited about working back at home is the amount of problems, number one, the amount of need for an intervention like that marries social and business together, right, which is in social entrepreneurship. When that happens, then in a way, Malaysia is much more exciting than Singapore. But also, people here are more diverse in nature and in culture and in backgrounds as well. So there is much more empathy of what's happening on the ground here with all our challenges, but also all the excitement that is generated bottom up.
You mentioned the hub. What is the Hub Singapore, and how did it fit? How did and does it fit within the ecosystem?
Well, it's first and foremost a community. We called it a community of purpose-driven people who would want to use their effort and time to leave a positive impact on the world. It's also a co-working space. So we have 5,000 square feet with 100 seats. There's a cafe in there. There's a sleeping corner. There are meeting rooms. There are places to hang your bicycles, brick walls, plants, and all these kind of things. So this is a home for social entrepreneurs and people who want to support this movement to come and work from. So by default, because we don't have walls, right? It's literally an open space. By default, people will start talking to each other, and friendships are formed from a very casual setting. And when friendships are formed, trust is being created, and that's where collaborations can happen very, very organically. So I would say that we were the first committee of this kind in the country, and now it is definitely the biggest as well. And we're attracting all the companies. We have had maybe 60 CEOs walking through the doors, mayors, ministers, right? Even the prime minister knows about the hub. So with such a mass, a critical mass of entrepreneurs from the ground, it attracts the right attention.
A takeaway from that, I suppose, is the importance of being able to foster communication, because that can be hard, I think, especially when you're crossing, you're not exactly crossing any lines, you're just trying to communicate with people outside your organization. Mm-hmm. And did you find just kind of creating that space to be what was necessary?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's why I often say that it's really about creating the right environment for collaborations and innovations to happen, and not necessarily engineering the innovations themselves.
I'm speaking today to Grace Tsai, the co-founder of The Hub Singapore, as well as advisor for social entrepreneurship for Magic, as well as Cal Joff, director of Tandemic, and we are discussing how to build an ecosystem for social innovation. Coming up, we address a little bit more about what Malaysia might be lacking at this point in time on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lint. Today with Cal Joff, director of Tandemic, and Grace Tsai, co-founder of The Hub Singapore and advisor for social entrepreneurship for Magic. We're discussing building an ecosystem for social innovation, especially in terms of the learnings that we can take from different countries. Cal, how did you address the skepticism towards the concept of social enterprise in Malaysia, especially during its initial stages?
I think it's very hard to actually try to directly address the skepticism. One of the key things is really showing examples of what it can be. So it's not sufficient to just talk about what social entrepreneurship is and how it's defined, but, you know, these are real organizations that are creating good on the ground. But in many cases, you know, we talked to people about it in 2009, and some of them, you know, today or, you know, last couple of months are starting to come back to us and say, hey, this social enterprise thing is actually kind of interesting. So I think it's also a matter of timing and of sort of repeated exposure to these kinds of concepts.
And from 2009 to now, what do you think Malaysia is lacking at this point in time?
Well, I think the single biggest issue is still helping grow the number of entrepreneurs that are in this space. So a lot of entrepreneurs will tell you, well, there isn't enough funding in the space. And I think that is to some extent true. But actually, we have a ton of funding that is starting to come into the space now. And the real challenge is helping people come up with really great ideas to launch, and having people make that commitment to sort of say, you know what, I'm going to quit my job in corporate and I'm going to go and start a social enterprise that addresses some kind of important issue.
Is it that kind of either-or dichotomy, though? You know, could somebody have a foot in each boat, so to speak, and continue to live life in the corporate world to a certain extent, as well as become a social, you know, entrepreneur? Or is it really, truly a full-time commitment and there's no other way about it?
I think that social entrepreneurship is already putting your foot into two different boats. So on one side, you're working on building a profitable, financially sustainable enterprise, and on the other, you're trying to handle beneficiary groups, and that's not always easy. So I really do think it's a full time kind of job, but the process of starting up a social enterprise is not necessarily that. So we often encourage people who are thinking about social enterprise to start it and to try in small ways, you know, see whether people are willing to buy your product or find, you know, different ways of testing it out before you make that jump.
Yeah, I would also say realistically that it is unrealistic to think, you know, or to expect people to take that jump immediately. If most people, you know, have commitments, and especially those who have families, right? But I would say that 0.x% of any country have entrepreneurial individuals. And if you are in that 0.x% of that population, then you might want to have one foot in a normal job and one foot trying out what you think your passion or your interest area is. And there will be one point where you find yourself putting more time doing the thing that doesn't pay than the thing that pays. And that's when you know that you actually be happier pursuing something that by that time hopefully will be more sustainable on its own.
Is there an issue in terms of, in the first place, communicating the fact that there are social issues that need addressing to people?
I'm not sure about that. I think that there is quite a bit of exposure for different kinds of social issues. We've heard a lot about homelessness in the last few months, for example. Education is an issue that I know many, many Malaysians are very passionate about. So it's not that the issue is there. It's more that there is an opportunity that you can do something about it, right? A lot of people look at these challenges and say, wow, this is such a big challenge. Like, how could I do anything about this? And then to see that other Malaysians are actually taking some of these challenges up in small ways is, I think, really encouraging. And then it breaks that thinking.
Grace, you're advising the Malaysian Global Innovation and Creativity Center, or MAGIC. What is MAGIC at the moment doing to address this gap of this lack of social entrepreneurs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so MAGIC as an organization, although it is government-linked, first of all, it is run by entrepreneurs. Almost the entire team were ex-entrepreneurs or, you know, serial entrepreneurs even. And so that's how it is very fundamentally different, because we do understand entrepreneurs at its core. And Cheryl, who is the CEO of MAGIC, is very well-known in Malaysia now. And she you know, prioritizes social enterprise a lot as well in MAGIC. And one of the things that I've started helping them with is really understanding the needs of our target group, right, which is the entrepreneurs themselves. So when I started the hub, I had 400 coffee chats to really understand the needs of people. And now I think in Malaysia, I'm at my maybe 50th coffee chat. So if there are any listeners out there who would want to share some of your observations and insights and suggestions on what MAGIC can do as well, I'm all ears. But for now, the hypothesis is really around, we want to be the, we want Malaysia to be the startup capital of Asia for startups, right? And we want to nurture and grow Malaysia entrepreneurs to be regional and global entrepreneurs. And that is both for tech, non-tech, and social enterprises. And we do that by looking at the entire life cycle of that individual, right? From early stage ideation to seed funding to joining accelerator programs that we are also creating, all the way to exits or you know, global partnerships to extend their impact.
And I think that this idea of KL or Malaysia really becoming a startup capital in this region, it has some real meat behind it. I mean, Grace and I were just talking earlier about how there are, in fact, more social entrepreneurs in Malaysia than in Singapore. And that's something that's very exciting for us, and it's very promising as well.
Does Malaysia have the talent pool or critical mass necessary to make the social enterprise landscape a sustainable ecosystem? Because I think starting something up is quite different from having it be this long-lasting sustainable action.
My answer is a definite big yes. Having said that, there is also a lot of talent outside of Malaysia. So Malaysians who have gone abroad to study or to work, maybe it's time to come home to help the country.
I think that's a general sentiment, really. And Tandemic and The Hub share similar aspirations in terms of social innovation. What are some of the success stories that have come out of both your organizations?
Well, for Tandemic, one of the big things that we have been working on for the last little while is volunteering. And so we help incubate and spin off an organization called Do Something Good. It's now Malaysia's largest volunteering platform. We work with over 300 NGOs, helping them source volunteers and do all kinds of good work. I would say, you know, one of the other things that is surprising to me, it wasn't really by design, is that a number of people who were sort of Tendemic alumni have gone off and started social enterprises themselves. So this year we have three alumni who've taken in awards from Singapore, from, you know, the British Council Entrepreneurs for Good, and all starting very innovative social enterprises. So I think, you know, people have sort of had a chance to work on social innovation projects within the sort of safety, I guess, of Tendemic, and a number of them then have gone off and said, hey, I'm going to start my own social enterprise, and that's really great to see.
Grace?
Yeah, from the Hub, we have startups that have raised a couple of rounds of funding. You know, we've got Meetup, which is the Kiva of India, raised 1.1 million US, led by an investor in residence from the Hub, you know, extending more microfinance to women in India. We've got startups like Playmula, who have created a financial literacy game that teaches kids from a young age on how to save and how to invest money. And we've got 500 members and over 180 startups, right? All of which, you know, might not have gotten that visibility if they didn't come together. And matching them with corporate partners, with government agencies to solve city-level problems and bringing some of their innovation and creative juice into companies. I think these effects and impact may come in maybe in 5 years, 8 years, but it's definitely happening right now.
So what approach or model should support organizations in Malaysia adopt? Are we, you know, overly focused on just the cities at the moment?
I think one observation that is common here and in the world generally is the lack of business rigor to fuel someone's passion, right? Passion alone is not enough. A business plan cannot be built on hope and on wishes, right? So business education, business acumen, talking to entrepreneurs who have gone through the battleground, talking to investors, these are very crucial things for anyone who wants to start out. So really don't you know, think that just because you have an idea and 180% passion, that is sufficient. That is definitely needed, but you need a community of mentors, of investors, of entrepreneurs, of peers that would actually speed up your own success curve and make the journey less lonely.
Looking at it from an investor's point of view, what is the basic investment criteria of any social enterprise? Because I think if, you know, for people listening who are now thinking, yes, I want to solve, you know, the water issue here in Malaysia, for example, and, you know, planning to go out and try and get that investment, yeah, what do they need to be able to communicate?
Yeah, there are two kinds of investors, largely. The first type is impact-first investors. These are people who would give money or lend money to deliver first your social impact, and they will put the financial return as second place, right? And then there's the other group, who is finance-first impact investors, where they would care about your return on investment. Some people would want market rate returns at 15% or more, and some people are, you know, happy with a single-digit return, like 2 to 7%, which is very common in social enterprises. But by and large, there are three things that investors look out for. First one is really the quality and the credibility of the entrepreneur. How driven are you? How much perseverance are you, and how deeply do you understand your problem? The second thing is how innovative your solution is. Is it being supplied already by competition outside, right? How is yours 10 times better, cheaper, faster, or more accessible? And finally, how scalable is your solution? If you are already, you know, able to prove that you're impacting, let's say, 10 villages or 100 people now, how can we bring that solution to impact 100,000 people?
What then is the biggest challenge that Malaysian social entrepreneurs face currently? Is it a matter of investment, lack of support?
I would say that it is partly that, but also partly a lack of people. In order to really build great social enterprises, we need to be able to recruit top quality sort of people into our teams. And it's still very difficult to convince people to sort of make the jump into social entrepreneurship.
So what is the role of government in social innovation, or in terms of making that encouragement, making it a bit more palatable?
I think it's really, you know, get the whole country excited about this new path of success and this new career option as well. It is really signaling that it is possible to make money and meaning at the same time, because traditionally, our parents and traditional mindset people do not think that's possible, right? It's binary. You either get rich or you do good. Or you get rich first and
then
do good later,
do good.
Right?
Yes.
When you're 60 years old. Yeah. So there is this whole generation of us, the Gen Ys, born 1980 and above, who really, really want meaning in our job right from get-go. And that has to be celebrated, because active citizens can create a lot of positive impact for a country. And the government needs to signal that it supports innovation and entrepreneurship in general. And then I often say also that then the government should actually back off and let these innovations fail and succeed and fly and breathe and grow on their own. And if they die, they die. But where it can come back in is towards the later stages of a venture, where you can help them scale globally, nationally, right? Or you can even be a customer or a partner to the smaller social venture. So the beginning part and the end part of a life cycle is where I think the government can play a vital role in.
It can be a little bit of a chicken and egg situation, right? Because it's like, do I create the ecosystem and hope people come, or do I wait for them to be there and then create the ecosystem around them? So at this point in time, for the government to sort of signal that it's open to encouraging social entrepreneurship, should it create the ecosystem and hope that, you know, entrepreneurs can flourish within it? Or are we still kind of at that phase where we're trying to recruit?
I think we're very much at the phase where we're trying to recruit. I mean, both things need to happen at the same time. I mean, for me, that's very clear. But if we create the ecosystem first, and then there's no one to fill in into it, then there's no point, right? And so we really need to do that recruitment, and that's the key thing to making it successful. Now, one of the important things that government can do to facilitate that is to provide social entrepreneurship legitimacy. So a major role in government, and Malaysia is one of the, you know, I feel few countries where government can actually provide legitimacy to things. It can do so for social enterprise by recognizing it as a form of, as a valid activity and as a form of, you know, enterprise.
Startups and entrepreneurs are almost always concentrated in cities. Is this to the deterrent of rural pilot projects? And this is, of course, a very, very important and relevant question here in Malaysia, you know, where we still have a really large rural community.
Mm. I actually think that there are more innovators and entrepreneurs in rural areas than we know. They do not label themselves as entrepreneurs or startups, what more as social entrepreneurs, but they exist, right? I believe that innovations happen the most in resource-constrained areas. This is where people get the most creative, using whatever resources they have to make something work, right? Sometimes it's called frugal innovation. Sometimes it's called resource-constrained innovations. And I truly believe there are lots of this in rural... Not believe, we know. We know by talking to many organizations and partners on the ground. Now, how do we get them the right platforms to scale their work? And for those of them who are ready for growth and need to raise a funding round, how do we show them in front of investors? I think that's more the question.
Yeah, and that was exactly going to be my next question, because I think something that's come out of our conversation today definitely has been the importance of community and communication, right? Of social entrepreneurs speaking to one another and that fostering a really sustainable ecosystem. Yeah. So how then do we reach out to entrepreneurs in rural areas who may be social entrepreneurs but may not have labeled themselves as such and may not necessarily have the platform that people in urban areas do?
I think one of the smartest and quickest ways would be to work with on-the-ground partners who are already present in many of these areas. I Am For You, for example, I must mention, you know, it's an amazing organization that has a reach to a million people, right? So has the Ministry of Youth and the Ministry of Education and the Ministry of Transportation. So how do we build on top of these existing networks to leverage on the mission of social entrepreneurship?
And finally, you know, we talked about passion. So what message would you have for people who are listening to this and thinking, okay, ready to take that jump? What advice would you have to offer?
Well, for me, I think you have to run experiments with your passion. You have to try different things. If you allow your job to take over your entire life, then it'll be very difficult to figure out, you know, A, what is your passion, and B, is it something that you really want to pursue? It could potentially pursue full time. So what that means is getting involved with social organizations on weekends, thinking about, you know, talking to other people who are in the social enterprise space about something that you might be interested in starting, just to get feedback and find whether there are small ways to actually start that sort of on the side.
Mm. Yeah, for me, if any of you feel like you are unhappy in your current job or situation and you want more meaning in life and you feel like you're entrepreneurial, how do you know that? Okay, first of all, a few people say that you are crazy, a few people say that you are very stubborn, where you're always finding better ways of doing things and you're restless. All these characteristics point to the fact probably that you are an entrepreneur. And if you want to use that talent and that energy and that passion to doing good, and delivering impact to the larger society and the country as well, then you probably are a social entrepreneur. Do not harp on these passions and feelings alone. Come and reach out to us. Come and reach out to your closest community builder or communities out there. And, you don't know, but I think there is a bigger family out there than you would think. And so come find it.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Cal Joff, Director of Tandemic, and Grace Tsai, co-founder of The Hub Singapore and advisor for social entrepreneurship for Magic. We've been discussing building an ecosystem for social innovation on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.